Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Bongiorno. I'm joined today by my good friend, Mr. Mike Fischetti. How are you, sir?
I'm good, but I need to take this time, as my lawyers have advised me, to apologize. I did promise a lot of PS5s and gift cards, and I know many of you showed up, and I didn't have them. I didn't think that was an issue. Yeah, sorry. I had to make that joke.
It's okay. There's lots going on. Twitter's called X now, huh? What the fuck is that?
I mean, yeah, I don't know how. Like, listen, I don't really care for Twitter anyway. The whole thing could burn down. It could burn down tomorrow, and I would be all right with it.
It kind of is. It's just slow motion, kind of burning to the ground. Yeah. So we're talking about something today that's really kind of specific, but as I was preparing for the episode this week, I found that it got me thinking about actually really relevant contemporary things. So what we're here to talk about today is an unreleased documentary called The Sweatbox. And The Sweatbox is a documentary by Trudy Styler and John Paul Davidson. That documents the making of the Disney animated film The Emperor's New Groove, which is from 2000?
It ended up coming out in 2000.
And if you don't know anything about that film, it began really as a very different thing and went through many different painful iterations. And it ended up being documented because Trudy Styler is the wife of Sting, and Sting was asked to do the music for the film, similar to, you know, this is at the end of, or the tail end of the Renaissance. So, you know, you had Tim Rice and Elton John doing Lion King, and you had Howard Ashman doing Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid. So it was like, okay, who's out there? Okay, Sting, let's get Sting to be the guy who did. So as part of him saying, okay, I'll do it, he's like, can my wife document it? And if you look at the film, it was not going to be a movie. I think it was going to be a DVD extra features behind the scenes thing. But I think what happened is this production began to implode. She was there with a camera. Eventually Disney said, no, you cannot release this, but it came out anyway, or it's available out there anyway.
I mean, it's interesting because it's really not, I'll be honest, I feel like it lets them off pretty light. Like, it's yeah, I got to say, like, yeah, it doesn't look the best.
Right.
But at the same time, this is not, I mean, for years when I, you know, when you heard about the Sweatbox, before yeah. It was like easily available, you would always hear people murmuring or talk about it, be like, oh man, it just destroys them and it exposes them and it shows them, tearing down this wonderful film and making this piece of crap instead of death. Like, people made it sound so much worse. And I think, feel like if you really watch it, it's actually pretty fair to them. And it seems like most people in it are like fairly understanding, or like, you know, taking the criticism or what have you. Like, I don't know. Yeah.
I agree with you that it's not as incendiary as you might think it's going to be when you get into it. Like you said, you hear it's this documentary that they don't want you to see. Oh my God. But in fact, all of these people, especially the higher up mucky mucks, are very media trained, and they are narrativizing as it's going on. So a lot of the talking heads are saying this is a normal part of the process, blah, blah, blah. There's only one moment towards the end where somebody goes, you know, this really isn't that normal.
No, it is. Yeah. It is true. Yeah. Cause it's like, if you've looked into the history of, like, especially like Disney animation, like how they work, like a lot of what you see is fairly accurate, right? And even Pixar as well, if you've looked at, if anybody's ever interested, Michael Arndt did a, for lack of a better word, I'll call it a documentary, but it's more like a writing advice thing about the lessons he learned on Toy Story 3. It's on his YouTube page. It's like an hour and 10 minutes. And he basically just talks to him, and he names everybody who was in the room and is just like, they sat there and they told me, like, this is terrible or that is terrible. Like, they, you know, Pixar didn't give him any problem releasing it. In fact, they gave him stuff to add to it. So
yeah,
it's interesting.
No, I agree with you. And you know, I found myself asking a lot of questions as I watched it. I sort of was asking myself, is this typical or is this not? Am I watching a bad process or in fact a very good process? And why then does Disney not want it out? Because like you said, it doesn't, it shows them doing a process. The Emperor's New Groove, I think, is a completely middling movie. It's not really bad. It's not really good. It's okay.
Let's be honest here. I think that's what it is. If the movie was successful, they wouldn't have cared. Because the movie wasn't a success there, I think people could have read it as, oh, this is why it wasn't good.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Also, I think there's a sort of auteurist fandom that probably believes that the original version, Kingdom of the Sun, was probably a masterpiece. And from what I saw, it was not a masterpiece.
Well, actually, I have to say, if there's one thing that I sort of am disappointed about with it as a documentary, or it might not even be the fault of it as a documentary, it just might be not what they were looking to show because that wasn't their point. But like, how do I put this? You never really get a full, clear understanding of what Roger Ailes' version of the story is. Like, what is Kingdom of the Sun? What is the actual story? Yeah, you get ideas, but you never really have a firm.
I went and watched Emperor's New Groove yesterday for the first time in 23 years.
Yeah, wow.
And after watching that, I watched the documentary again, and I think I got the difference. Well, actually, I think there's three films that happened, right? The original version, which was the sort of brainchild of Roger Allers, who had worked on a lot of the Renaissance movies, and he directed The Lion King. And sadly, after this failure, which he walked away from, the only other Disney film he directed was Open Season, which is another sort of massive
Open Season? Wait, I don't even think that was a Disney film.
Was it not? Oh, it's an animated film.
It is an animated film.
I thought it was a Disney film. Let me check the IMDb, folks. Open Season. Oh, no, it's, I think it might be, what do you call it? Where is it? No, Sony.
I was just looking at it too. I was like, yeah, that was not a Disney film.
And some other animated feature, and then a bunch of shorts. So from like the director of The Lion King, it's sort of been a bummer for him since.
Oh, actually, sorry, not to tangent, but I do think this is really interesting, and it's interesting you say that.
Yeah.
So a couple of years ago, I went to a lecture series where they had several people who were part of the Disney Renaissance talking about it and talking about like storytelling and things like that. Don Hahn was one of the speakers, producer of The Lion King, Beauty and the Beast, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And he was asked during the Q&A section, someone brought up, they said, I love Waking Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah.
Which is a documentary he made. And we can talk about that a little later. But like and the person said, you know, hey, would you ever think about doing like a sequel and showing all the other films that you made, like those other Renaissance films, those other 90s films, because we love them and we want to hear about the making of them. And what I thought was really interesting was Don Hahn you could tell like he physically changed and he was sort of like, no, because for us, that's when everything got bad.
Interesting.
I think it's it really is that there is a difference between we, the audience, and how we perceive things and how we've grown up with them.
Yeah.
Versus the artists who felt like Lion King was our peak, was our top of the mountain. It never got better than that. And then everything after that was considered, you know, not as good or a failure or whatever. Like it was just not considered
a harder working condition because you had more hands you had more voices at the top straining something.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I just know that like you could tell like there was a chef. And I feel like that's really unfortunate because a lot of those films are still really good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And deserving of like praise and consideration and I would, you know, hope that the artists know, yeah, I know it wasn't whatever. It didn't make $375 million like The Lion King, but trust me, that doesn't mean that it wasn't good or impactful or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I want to say up front that cinema is a very hard, you know, it's a hard stew to make. Mm. And Lisa, and I'm not really an auteurist. I'm a big believer in the collaborative nature of cinema. And I think there's a lot of great films with similar stories to this that turned out to be a success. I mean, like, I know you're not a huge fan of The Wizard of Oz, but The Wizard of Oz had multiple directors, cast, people recast, major injuries, rewrites, turns out to be The Wizard of Oz. You know, a more contemporary example would be Iron Man. Iron Man was a complete shit show. They were rewriting it on the day before the takes, and it ended up being a very good superhero movie that launched a fucking multimedia empire. So I don't think I would never look at a production and say, well, that's why it's bad, because movies are hard to make. And I mean, look, fucking Charlie Chaplin would sometimes make a movie. He was such a perfectionist. He'd make a movie and then he'd go, you know what? Let's do it again. And then remake the movie again. So I think it's a certain magic that ends up happening anyway. And, you know, like when people online go, oh, did you hear there's going to be reshoots on this new film? I'm a little scared. I always think, don't be scared of reshoots.
Yeah.
Scared of when they don't do reshoots. Reshoots is a good, normal part of the process. Movies are hard to make.
Yeah, no. I wholeheartedly agree. And in fact, like, here's the thing, though. I think that this movie, though, brings up an interesting dichotomy with that sentiment. Because on the one hand, yes, I film is a very... It's a very stern taskmaster. It is very difficult. It's hard. It is so hard to make a good movie. If you've never made one, I almost have to you don't understand. Until you've made a film, like you almost don't understand just how hard it is to even make like something okay. So
yeah.
That being said, the thing I feel like though with this movie is it really depends on kind of if you believe that the Roger Allers version of the movie is authentically good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then it feels like, then you read it as, here comes Pete Schneider and Tom Schumacher.
Yeah.
Who, with just, in just 10 minutes, can be like, yeah, no, we didn't like it. We think it's this or that. It doesn't work.
Right, yeah, right.
And that it then feels like, you know, we have all these artists working on it. And it's like, you telling me that, like, these two adults in the room,
yeah,
their say is so, like, they know storytelling and movie, like, they know things so well that all these other really smart people who are working together can't see, or like yes it's good to have like outside feedback, but there's almost like a certain degree where it's like, really, that this everything's gotta land on these two guys?
Right. And
it
makes me think also of the sort of wastefulness of Hollywood. Because at that point, Harvey Fierstein had put in a performance. Owen Wilson. So much was done. And you think, at this point, these guys come in to I understand, like, you know, the process. You have to keep, as part of the process, you have to keep checking in. You have to keep getting fresh eyes. You have to keep moving things. But it feels like a lot of it was made. And then they came in. And then it became something else twice. Here, all right, I want to go back.
Please do.
Off track, but I want to go back to what you were saying about, do you believe, you know, what are your feelings on what you think the original Roger Allers film was? I don't know if it was good or bad, but what I do know, it was attempting something more than Emperor's New Groove. I think that's the problem. Because there's really three films. There was Empire of the Sun. Kingdom of the Sun, which was this big epic. It was based slightly on a novel that was kind of like a Prince and the Pauper novel. It had a bunch of different storylines. And then they said, okay, the first big change was, there's too much going on. Let's focus this. Let's remove some of these storylines and just focus on this one part about the prince being turned into, or the emperor being turned into a llama. And that's fine. And that became Kingdom in the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But then, and here's where I think things went down the drain. Then after working on that, they came in and said, no, we don't like this either. Let's just make it a sitcom. Let's just make it a comedy. Let's take out the music. It's not a musical anymore. Let's take out any any reaching for anything more, forget it. Only comedy. Comedy is the only thing that we think is working, so that's all we're going to do. And that's where I feel like the failure is. The cutting off the ambition.
Yeah, there is a sense of them. Yeah, and it's, how do I put this? It's not the, I feel like it's not the artist, quote unquote, but it really is. It's coming down to like Pete Schneider and Tom Schumacher there, who were the heads of who were the heads at the time. And I get it, like they're the executives and they have people to answer right. to and da 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 da. But it was interesting to see that, like, you're right. Like, it basically comes down to, we're just making a straight comedy with a very simple thing. And also, it's interesting in this documentary, you can tell that, like, Sting is, like, kind of not on board with it.
Yeah. Like, he's one of also, the most interesting parts.
He is. And he's just like, oh, I'm not a quitter, though. So I just have to keep going.
Well, at one point he says, hopefully they'll fire me. If I'm lucky, yeah. they'll fire me. He really is unhappy. I mean, he wrote 6 songs that I believe only one is used during the credits.
That sounds right.
Because it's not a musical. The final film ends up not being a musical, and he was working on a musical.
Well, it's almost like they took, if you've seen Tarzan is not a musical, but it does have killer songs in it.
Right.
Phil but Collins. They even cut down from that, where like, okay, you know, it went from, oh, we're just sort of doing kind of all Broadway style musicals to here's our movies with really good songs in it to we're going to put a song at the beginning and a song at the end and call it a day.
Right. And one of the songs we're going to have Tom Jones sing.
Because that's really going to get the kids in there. The kids love that Tom Jones.
They do. So at one point in the documentary where I felt like, oh, this has become bankrupt is, you know, it if you don't know anything about Emperor's New Groove, is it takes place during the Incan Empire. And at one point towards the end, when they're going straight for comedy, one of the production people or one of the designers says like, we're kind of moving. We're still in the Incan Empire, but we're moving in a more playful direction. It's kind of like the Incan Empire, but like Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And I was like, oof, okay.
Sting has that line. Sting.
Yeah. Say it.
Sting basically has this line where he's like, I sort of hate that I'm doing this thing for this company where they're just taking this these other people's culture and they're like mashing it up and simplifying it and Americanizing it and like making it like a, you know, like a Happy Meal or whatever.
Yeah.
That anybody can eat anywhere. And he's like, but at the same time, I thought that was very interesting. It's like, I don't blame the animators, the artists, because they are within the structure of this company. And
yeah.
Like, I don't think anybody is doing it to be malicious, but like, this is what's happening. And I think this is also arguably like a difference that you see in the Disney company in years since, especially with something maybe like Moana or yeah. Pixar with Coco, trying to be more authentic in some respects to the culture of origin of the piece.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit. God, there's so many threads we can pull on.
Yeah, it's not.
Can you explain to people listening what the title means, the sweatbox?
Oh, so the sweatbox refers to way back when Disney Animation like first started, they would screen the movies when they would screen like animation first getting put together. They would screen it in this outdoor, like in this shed, basically. Mm-hmm. So it had no air conditioning.
Yeah.
So you would go in there and like you would sweat all day because you're sitting in a hot box, basically.
You also had Walt there, and you're there showing him a cartoon and watching Walt watch your work. So that's also making you sweat.
And he's also usually not happy with it. So, you know.
Right. So that's why it's called the Sweatbox. It's a very fun name, I think, for what we have here, because there are the sort of documentary is kind of built around these two big moments of, Schneider and Schumacher coming in and being like, okay, let's see what you got and how brutal it is. I mean, after the first one, when they're just talking about how none of it works, well, I don't understand. There's so much going on. What kind of a movie? Where is the movie? You haven't found the movie. There's a shot of Roger Allers, and you can see his soul leaving his body.
Go on. Yeah, no, and it's funny because even Sting, that's the thing. I think Sting's just like, I think it's pretty good. What are you talking about?
Right.
Did we see the same movie?
Yeah. Here's the thing, like,
and I think that,
that's
just, but anyway, like, if anything, that's what makes you as the audience member, like, really start to question, was this Aller's version actually good?
Well, here's, I guess to get back to the point I was saying before, like, okay, let's say it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I think then you go, okay, this doesn't work, but you're an artist that's done a lot for us. Let's help make it work. But what they did instead was a fire sale. They said, this don't work, that don't work. This one little thing, the jokes that work. So fuck everything else. Fuck all the other thoughts you had. Fuck all the other dreams you had for this. We're not going to make those elements work. We're going to cut them out and focus on the one thing we think is working. And that, to me, is what's bankrupt. Not that we're going to keep working on it. Not that his vision was great. It probably was a muddled mess. But there's a difference between saying, let's work on all these things and make it work, than saying, you know what, guys, our ambition was too high, or your ambition was too high, and we don't want to try to achieve your ambition. So we're just going to cut and run, basically.
Yeah, and I think here's the thing is, because they do show us animated segments, some of the songs, like they show you like how it would have played out in the movie.
Yeah.
And like, even from just those little snippets, you're like, there is something good here. It felt like there is something. And the fact that you could have, you know, these guys sitting there and being like, oh, nothing works, this is terrible, that's terrible. I'm like, no, you've got some diamonds there. I get that it might not be connecting the way that it should be.
Right.
But to just whole cloth say that the only thing that works is the llama song and the love song, like, I was like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, in the documentary, they show some of Eartha Kitt's songs, and they're great. Yeah. And they're not in the film, the final film at all. There is no, Eartha Kitt does not sing at all in the final film. And she had some interesting songs in the original version.
And that's also one of the things that I think is interesting is the documentary also shows you, what's his name? Is it Alex? I apologize, I'm blanking on his name. Deja. Hang on, wait. No, I'm going to be embarrassed if I get this wrong.
Sure. Mike is turning to his library of Disney.
I really am.
He's thumbing
through. Andreas Deja, who's a legendary Disney animator. Uh-huh. Legendary. The fact that he was animating Eartha Kitt's character initially, who's what's her name? Because she's in the final version. She's just different.
Yeah. What's
Yzma.
Yzma.
So he initially animated Yzma, and you could see how excited he is. And once they basically come back and are like cutting it and stripping it to this more like comedic story, you see the same thing. Like, he's like, yeah, I'm not going to do this because this isn't good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not what I signed up for. I'll go work on something else.
Yeah. Right. And the same thing happens with Allers. You know, it begins with two directors, Roger Allers and Mark Donnell. And after the first big shakeup, you see, I was talking about it. He's comparing it to his daughter going to college. He's like, you lose your baby and it's heartbreaking. But he's like, I can't be. And they let him leave because he just was like, I can't, just let me go. Like, I can't work on this version. So then it becomes all Mark Donnell. You know, they left. And I don't know. I mean, maybe if he had stayed, he could have fought to make it a little bit more, because he was clearly the captain of the ship. And maybe, and Sting was really like on board with his vision. Maybe if, and I don't fault him for leaving after the brutal, how brutal that was, especially after, you know, delivering the Lion King. You know what I mean? Like, I think maybe if he had stayed, he could have kept it from going in the direction it went in, which was just like, how do we take what we have and just commodify this right here?
I was going to say, like, I imagine maybe it could have been something like a Hunchback of Notre Dame or a Pocahontas, where, while imperfect, I would much rather have those movies than The Emperor's New Groove.
Well, in general, as a film lover, I respect and are more interested in sloppy, kind of not totally achieving their goal messes that are ambitious than really sort of cheap, you know, manufactured little trinkets, which is what, you know, like The Emperor's New Groove is fine. And I know people who saw it when they were young love it. So I totally get that.
Yeah.
There is, it's funny and there is good things in it. And John Goodman's good in it. And it's not a bad movie. But it's, you know, it's very assembly line. And I would always prefer a glorious misfire.
It's funny. I feel like it actually has a lot of the problems that I feel like I see in not just animated movies, but like in all movies, in a lot of movies today, which is movies are, they have really, how about this? Like studios think that they've learned the lesson of how to make good movies or even to some degree of quality by sticking to structure, by really firmly sticking to whether it's the Blake Snyder, you know, beat sheet style of storytelling, whether it's just simple three act structure, whether it's Chris Vogler's hero's journey, whatever. Like, it seems to me that they are so just satisfied with or sticking to these pre-formatted structures of storytelling that it makes the movies passable.
Yes.
It takes a bad movie and makes it just okay. But that's it, is it's just okay. It's middling. It's
right.
It's quote unquote, like almost like inoffensive. It's just, it is. So it's like, you can't argue that we made a bad movie. It's like, well, I can't argue you made a really good one either.
Right.
You made a movie.
Right. It's so, in some ways it's almost like this documentary is the end, the sort of other book end to The Waking Sleeping Beauty.
In a way, yeah.
That film begins with the troubled production of The Black Cauldron and how Disney had kind of lost its way. And then these new innovative voices coming in and, you know, that huge run of Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Beauty and the Beast, Lion King, like that Disney Renaissance. And sort of that's why it's called Waking Sleeping Beauty. It's like Disney, the greatness of Disney sort of wakes back up. This is sort of like, it's almost like in that film, right? They make a machine and this machine is great. And by the time you get to the sweatbox, the machine works too well to the point where you could kind of put parts in it that aren't totally full and something will come out the other end, but it won't be great.
Well, I think it's also, you know, some of it, let's be honest, some of it becomes ego.
Sure.
Some of it becomes, you know, hey, we made these movies and they were hugely successful. And everybody tells us that we're really good. And yeah, you know what? We are really good. We are really smart about storytelling. We are the best. And when you don't necessarily stay humble, I feel like part of that comes to infect things. And I actually don't like the way that the documentary presents the scene, because I don't think it's entirely fair to the artists who are in that scene. So just sorry, let me be specific. So after, I want to say it was after that first screening where they ripped the movie apart, Roger Allers sits down with a number of very famous Disney animation directors, as well as like writers and producers, like other people.
Right. They have like a kind of like think tank.
They have a brain trust. They call it the brain trust, which is the same thing Pixar would call it as well. And they have, you know, Clements and Muster, and they have Kirk and Gary there, and Don Hahn. Like, they have all these great people. The way it's presented in the documentary is that they're all sort of like talking over one another and like giving these notes, and it makes all the notes feel unnecessary, confusing.
Right. It's irrelevant. Right. It's edited like blah, 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 all on Roger Allers' face. Like, he's just getting a bunch of information thrown at him. The editing makes it seem like they're all just going off and blabbing, you know?
Yeah. And that's why I was like, I don't think this is entirely fair. And I think like that is sort of asserting a certain idea in there.
Right.
But also, again, because we don't know, that's the one of the issues, like, because we don't know the full story, whether or not we then can judge for ourselves whether or not we think that was a good version of the story. Therefore, like, now we can't tell if this stuff he's getting is helpful or not, because we have no
Right.
We have no means of comparison.
Right. No, you're absolutely right.
But anyway,
yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. But I think that just sort of relates to this larger idea of, you know, what, you know, you mentioned, okay, so Waking Sleeping Beauty is sort of showing us how the machine gets created. For those who are there, they would probably argue that this movie almost shows this is the machine breaking, or this is what happens after the machine is broken, and it's just and it keeps going. This is like the negative side of it.
Right. I'd like to get your take on two of the big, so to speak, characters in this film.
Mm-hmm.
One is Peter Schneider,
mm-hmm.
Who was at the time president of Walt Disney Studios.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is Thomas Schumacher, who was who currently is the president of Disney Theatrical Group, but at the time was the president of Walt Disney Feature Animation. And I do want to say, before we get into anything else, in 2018, it was reported in the Wall Street Journal that he was under an internal investigation at Disney for inappropriate behavior and aggressive sexual language. I do not know how he's still with the company, so I don't know how that internal investigation ended, but I just wanted to say that.
It's funny you bring that up, because I remember hearing about it in 2018, and then I hadn't heard anything since. I never heard investigation,
right.
Like just, it just sort of was there and then disappeared. So these two guys, so like, I have some knowledge of them.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, these are two guys who came from, and they say it in the documentary, they came from theater. They both came from theater, which I think is interesting because the pacing of things is different in theater.
Mm-hmm.
Humor also makes a big difference in theater.
Uh-huh.
Like I just saw a play recently called Grey House, which was it's basically a horror play.
Yeah.
It's a horror movie on stage, but it was really funny.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's sort of done because on stage, if you don't have that humor to sort of break things up, or like if you don't have that humor, it makes plays feel really motionless.
Yeah.
And so like it helps with pacing. And so I sort of wonder, like, if that's coming in effect, like these guys, yes, they learned animation as they came in. But really, who was there when the major films were made? It was Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Yes.
Who, love him, hate him, or otherwise, like, he has a fairly good sense of movies. I do think one of my key issues with Katzenberg is he relies a little too heavily on modern pop culture references, as you would see when he goes over to DreamWorks.
Yeah.
And especially like if you look at like Shrek and Shark Tale and those kinds of movies. But he, to me, like at least read as a guy who better understood movies.
Yeah.
And
he's a big presence in the Waking Sleeping Beauty documentary.
Yeah. And I think like that's, and the sad thing is that really because of the distrust that Eisner had of him, that really soured things, because he could have, if he had stayed at the studio, he may have been a more stabilizing force than we give him credit for. Like, yes, there was definitely internally, I know Roy didn't like him. Like Roy had tension with him, and what was his name? Frank Wells was the one who kept the peace.
He passed away. Yeah, and he passed away.
Yes, and so it's really like if Frank Wells lived, who knows how much longer this could have gone.
Right, like you said, he kept the peace. So he was that sort of, Frank Wells, Michael Eisner, and Jeffrey Katzenberg were like, you know, ego, superego, and id. Like, Wells was like the superego. And so, like, without that, everything else doesn't work. It falls out of balance.
Yeah, no, it's true. And it's one of those things that I was, you know, sort of wonder about, was like, how could the films have been changed in that way? I think that both Peter and Thomas, like, they do the best that they can, and they're not malicious in their comments. They are trying to like make the best film possible. I just think ultimately, I don't know if it was, sometimes when you're just in it for too long, like, it's hard, you lose that sense of perspective. And also, I don't know if it's even the studio itself, the fact that they kind of just stuck with the same thing for a while. They didn't make a non-musical till Tarzan, I think.
Yeah. I agree with you that they're not malicious, but I do think that they are glib, and I think that they're a little careless. But again, like, I'm glad you brought up Katzenberg, because it's a good comp, because you see, like, in the Waking Sleeping Beauty documentary, like, Katzenberg come in and be like, okay, Black Cauldron isn't working, cut out 20 minutes, and everyone's like, oh my god, what are you saying? That's not something you can do in animation. And I don't know if it fixed that movie, but supposedly it made it a little bit better, and then we have this new era. He knew more, like you said. Like, he had that glibness and that cock of the walk swagger, but Schumacher and Schneider, they come in with the same ego, but I don't think they're as good as Katzenberg. So they come in with the same glib, blah, 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 blah. I mean, at one point, in a very awkward moment, I forget which one, one of the two of them, like, jokingly tells Sting to shut up.
Yes, I think that was Thomas Schumacher. Yeah. Yeah. I was shocked by when I heard that. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. And Sting handled it well. But, like, that was the moment you were talking about before, when they were like, what do you all think? And Sting goes, well, you know, I don't get what you're saying. I actually kind of like the movie. And so he jokingly goes, oh, shut up. But you can see Sting doesn't even crack a smile at that moment. Like, Sting's like, it's an awkward moment.
Yeah. It's one of those, like, I know you can joke with people, like, when you know them and that, like, I get that. But I do think it definitely reads as it was probably not suitable in that moment, and it came off less as joking and more as demeaning.
Yeah, and you could see Sting and Roger Allers are taking it so seriously, and Schumacher and Schneider are like making Coca-Cola, and I think that's what Sting is reacting to.
Well, so this is also, and so just, I just want to mention too, this is an interesting moment in the history of Disney as a company, and probably like their actions also reflect on the trouble that the company was in at the time.
Uh-huh.
So I think they say that they start putting this movie together in, it was like 96 maybe?
Yeah.
1996. All right. So that is 5 years from the opening of Disneyland Paris, then known as Euro Disneyland, which after its first year, Eisner was already talking about, we will close this if it's not successful, and would have been the first Disney park ever to close. You were talking about the loss of Frank Wells. They bring in Mike Ovitz to be chief operating officer, who was the head of he created CAA, the talent agency.
Yeah.
And, you know, Eisner brought him in and then gave him virtually no power, cut him off at the knees from the start, caused, you know, tension within the company, and he ends up leaving. And so, like, and then they have to do this huge payout to him because he's leaving. So the company's got that. The movies themselves start, you know, Pocahontas isn't the huge hit they expect it to be, nor is Hunchback of Notre Dame. Like, both of those are like $100 million movies, which for them at the time they consider more of a disappointment.
Yeah.
So you have this kind of mounting pressure and tension and this desire and this like need to succeed because things are not working in the company. I give them some credit, but also like put it in that context. Like, I then can see how and why they're suddenly like, oh, okay, we need to make this I don't think it's the best, and I think it robs the artists of the possibility of getting that Lion King, because you never know what this movie could have been, which is also, I think that's the issue. The core issue here is we're talking about a hypothetical, and so of course in the hypothetical we're going to tend to believe that this movie could have been great, but it also could have been terrible.
Right.
It could have been just as bad as what we got. We don't know.
yeah. Michael Eisner is not in the film at all.
Yeah, he goes to one screening, but yeah, we never hear from him or see him.
Do you think he had an edict out like the documentarians can't talk to me? To me, it's weird that he has no presence in it.
I don't necessarily know about that, because like even going back to the Waking Sleeping Beauty days, like Eisner was never that much in feature animation. That was, in fact, that was why he hired Katzenberg, was like, this is the feature animation division, and that's your problem now. Like, he, Eisner was never, he was never that big. How do I put this? He understood that it was important and it was part of the company and needed to be there, and they needed to make animated movies, but he was not interested in like inputting them as much as, believe it or not, like the parks. He had a lot more interest in the parks. He really was always interested in Imagineering. He liked to hang out there, and but also subsequently, like as things economically worsened, he would also really clamp down on them and be like, you know, hey, you got to make, we're building a second park in Paris, but you have like $500 million. Like, you have next to nothing.
Yeah.
And I can say, having been there this summer, that Walt Disney Studios Park in Paris is the worst Disney park in the world.
Okay. I have not been there.
It's, I feel like to call it a park isn't even worth it. Like, it's, I hate to say it, because Disneyland Paris is gorgeous and quite nice and is a really good park. It's just that this park, like, there's barely a cohesive theming. There's like barely lands. There's sort of like three lands. It's really small. And the fact that you can basically not get lost in there and find your way around because it's so small that like you just can't get lost. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just interesting that Eisner, he was always more interested in Imagineering and those kinds of ventures, more so than feature animation. He also was interested in live action, and that was because of him coming from Paramount and having that like understanding of live action. He famously, you know, said, because he greenlit Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he said, best script I ever read.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's part of why I don't think he was in. Okay. I don't think his absence is nearly as looming as one would think.
Okay, all right. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about Disney right now.
Yeah.
By the way, did you happen to read that New Yorker article that recently came out? I forget what it was called. It was basically the death of movies.
Everything. The Barbie about- one?
Was it the Barbie one? I didn't disagree with a lot of its points, but I disagreed with its general thesis. It was basically like, you know, everything's IP. It's a lot of things we know. Also, they spend too much. My thing currently, by the way, is they spend too much because they keep wanting to make Endgame again. And you know, like Haunted Mansion, which I liked, is being considered a failure because they spend too much on it.
How much did they spend on it?
I don't know.
I was going to say, I actually don't know what the budget was on that. Because that looked like it could have been 70 or 80 million. It looked like it could have been relatively a low budget for those kind, but I could be wrong.
I really loved the new Little Mermaid. I think it's the best of the remakes by far. And I honestly don't like many of the remakes. But I liked it. I liked what they did with it. But that's also being considered a disappointment. And Disney is, we were just talking about how what they did with The Emperor's New Groove was safe, just kind of making it a kind of sitcom. But Disney proper, Disney as a brand, all they're doing now is sort of making live action adaptations of their classic animated films. Now, as a corporation, they've got more going on. They've got, you know, Star Wars and Marvel and the parks and you know, whatever you might think about those things. But Disney, when it comes to Disney movies, they seem to be in a very weird place. And I'm wondering, what do you think about their current creative output?
So, their creative output's not good right now. And I don't think I'm stepping on any toes saying that. I think that's just the reality that, unfortunately, I mean, you know, so this summer, I'll be honest, I didn't see Elemental and I didn't see Little Mermaid. I did see Indiana Jones and I did see Haunted Mansion. And, you know, Haunted Mansion, I wasn't as hot on. I maybe I need to see it a second time. And Indiana Jones, I thought was just serviceable. Like
I was lukewarm on it myself.
Yeah. Like, if you ask me, where do I rank it in terms of Indiana Jones movies? It's probably for me 4 out of 5, like the fourth out of all five. So it's not that, you know, it didn't do that much for me, but also like it didn't offend me. It just didn't do much for me.
Right. See, I feel the same way about Elemental. I saw Elemental and there were things about it that I liked. And I do think they marketed it wrong. It was an immigrant story, and it should have been marketed as this is an immigrant story, and this is a story about mixed race couples and what they go through. And that's not at all really in the marketing.
I was going to say, like, what you're describing to me is not at all what I kind of thought, honestly, it was almost going to be like, because it, the way they market it, like, it almost looks like Inside Out, but a little different.
Right, right. Exactly. That's how they marketed it. So they marketed it wrong. But anyway, even though I had, there were things to like about it, I didn't love it. The last Disney film that I loved, Encanto. I loved Encanto. You know, the new Mary Poppins kind of left me cold.
Yeah.
I like Cruella.
Yeah, that was all right. That was...
You know, but it's just, I don't know.
I think...
Yeah.
Listen, here's the thing with Disney was they definitely bet too heavily on IP. On the IP that they have, they bet too heavily on it. They spent too much, just assuming it was going to make a bunch of money. And of course, right. That's what all these companies are doing, though. Like, I just want to put that in context, too. That
sure, it's not just them.
Yeah, like, this is sort of a reckoning for the whole studio system of...
Well, they own so much of it now. They've become such a conglomerate.
But here's the thing. I think now more than ever, my theory personally is that what they don't want to admit or realize is they try to make themselves conglomerates that they become so big that they're too big to fail.
Right.
The difference is you are not you're not a bank. Media yes. media companies are, frankly, kind of expendable in some ways. Like, media companies don't necessarily have to survive. They can be chopped up and sold and or they can be spun off. Like, it's not the same as a bank. So you actually can't make yourself too big to fail. Because in doing that, you know, Disney's been getting away. And I felt like this, too, for the last 10 years, 15 years or so. Like, they've been getting away with looking really good on a spreadsheet because one branch of the company will prop everybody else up.
Sure, yeah.
The parks and ESPN prop up everything else and make the rest of the balance sheet look great.
Right, right.
But once both of those start to tip or one starts, you know, all of a sudden, yeah, you can't. And for me, I really do wish, I don't think they ever will, although sometimes it sounds like maybe, you know, you hear those rumors and stuff. I just wish that they would sell off a lot of pieces.
Yeah.
Basically go back to your company that makes movies and your company that owns theme parks. Like, that's it. That is your business. Yeah.
I would love for them to sell off the Muppets to some other production company that has a vision of what to do with the Muppets. Unlike what Disney's done with the Muppets, which is every 5-6 years, they have a new plan and it works marginally or it doesn't work. And then they come back again with another new plan. I would love for the Muppets to be put in the hands of another company that could really put focus on it and have and I'm not saying a cinematic universe, but I'm saying a plan for the brand.
Well, okay. I mean, listen, I love the Muppets, but even I wonder, I don't know what you can do to get a big audience. I think this is also the problem with everything now is almost everything is niche. Superheroes are not general. They're becoming niche.
Mm-hmm.
The market is just becoming the people who really care and enjoy that stuff. And that's why, these movies are grossing less. It's the diehards will show, but regular moviegoers aren't coming out because they feel like they got the whole story with Endgame,
Right.
I've completed my journey. I'm good.
That's exactly how I feel about Marvel. Everything past Endgame, and we did it. We did the whole story.
You didn't create a new one. Like, that, I gotta say, everybody gives Marvel this tremendous amount of credit. Like, oh, their storytelling is so brilliant. And I was like, well, to be honest, what would have been brilliant was ending Infinity War with the original Avengers disappearing. And then you have all the other people left behind having to become a team. And therefore, you have a new, basically, first Avengers movie where everybody's coming together to save the old Avengers. And then you can have your big rousing finale. And then you actually have a team that people are invested in. Nobody is invested in, or even, I can't even tell you, who do I think is going to be in the next Avengers movie as a as team members.
I don't know. And for I don't know what they're aiming. I thought for a while their next big thing was like the Krull story, but then they just did that in a little TV series, which most people didn't like. So I don't know what they're building towards now, honestly. I have no idea.
I don't think that they know. I think that's also part of the problem, is they don't really know. They're kind of spinning their wheels. I think they had a lot invested in the Kang Dynasty, and now,
yeah,
let's be honest, that's probably not happening.
Right.
You know, and I just don't know how game they are to pivot. And I don't know if you heard recently, but there's sort of an, it's not like official, but there's a strong report that Vanessa Kirby is being cast as Sue Storm.
Uh-huh.
Sue Storm is going to be the lead of the next Fantastic Four movie. So it's not going to be like Reed Richards' movie. It's going to be Sue Storm's movie. And her brother, or that Johnny Storm, is going to be played by Jack Quaid. That one's a little less for sure. Reed Richards was offered to Matt Smith, but I think Matt Smith turned it down. I just think it's like, I think it's interesting if they're trying to line up the Fantastic Four in as almost this like Hail Mary pass, even though, again, outside of like the hardcore comics community, I don't think the general public cares about the Fantastic Four.
No, I agree with you. You know, this is maybe a pivot in our conversation, but after reading that New Yorker piece, and I do apologize for not remembering the name of it or the writer of it, but it was basically and this happens all the time, it was the most current eulogy for cinema. It was, here's everything that's wrong. And I had a thought based on something else that I was reading, because I was reading a book on burnout in millennials. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to that IP thing and the nostalgia thing, you know, if you look at it from the point of view of just the film industry, you know, the criticism would be that there's no new ideas, or that they are just trying to make safe bets. But I started to think, when I was reading this book about burnout, there's probably something more culturally there, because millennials and younger are the first generations of Americans that are less successful than the previous generations. The millennials and Gen Z and younger will maybe never retire, increasingly held down by debt, student loan debt, credit card debt, unable to buy things. And I wonder if that is why we want fucking IP. Like, maybe that's why I want, you know, like a new Ninja Turtles movie or a new Ghostbusters movie, because when I was a kid, it was the last time that I thought there was a future.
Well, okay, actually, it is interesting you bring that up, because I actually, my theory that kind of could run alongside that is that actually the reason we see a lot of IP and the reason we see a lot of repeat stuff, or we're taking older things and bringing them back and rebooting and all that, actually has more to do with none of us want to deal with contemporarily what is going on in our world. We do not want to deal with the present, and we will do anything we can to not. So maybe we'll use a story about the past to like kind of talk about the present, but we're not directly talking about it.
I think that's definitely part of it. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's, people talk about superhero movies, blah, 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 blah. All right, forget about the specificities of superhero movies. If you look at it broadly, they're escapist film. And the escapist film is more popular than ever, probably because our current living realities stink. We're living through hard economic times from 2009 to now. Maybe sometimes Wall Street does better, but for the average working middle-class person, it's still been a struggle. You have climate change, which is only getting worse. You know, of course, there was a global pandemic, politics that have gone completely fucking insane, the rise of fascism again. Maybe I do want to go see the Guardians of the Galaxy, and they, you know, they can run around and play pop songs, and it makes me not think about that I'm not being paid enough, I have no money for retirement if I ever get to retire, things like that.
Well, so it's interesting, because I'm fairly certain that we're thinking of the same New Yorker article.
Yeah.
And in that article, one of the quotes came from an agent at UTA who basically says, and this is to me like the more sort of damning, chilling, tough part is he says, we basically live in a time, you know, could we argue that we, sorry, actually, give me a second, because I want to correctly quote this gentleman. I don't want to misquote him.
Yeah, if you could find, I haven't been able to find it. If you could find it, please give us the author of the article as well.
Yeah, so this is the article I was thinking of. It's called After Barbie, Mattel is Raiding Its Entire Toy Box. the article is written by Alex Barash.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a quote. So the quote here, again, this is from... let's see. Although Barber was pleased, sorry, let me skip on down just to get to like the meat of it. Okay, sorry, I'll read the whole thing. So, although Barber was pleased with Barbie partnership, he was clear-eyed about its implications. Is it a great thing that our great creative actors and filmmakers live in a world where you can only take giant swings around consumer content and mass-produced products? I don't know. But it is the business. So if that's what people will consume, then let's make it more interesting, more complicated. He wondered aloud whether such directors such as Hal Ashby and Sidney Pollack would be making movies with Mattel if they were alive today. It's a super interesting question. It's also an argument that we've lost already.
Yes, I think we are absolutely talking about that same article.
Yeah, and it's that quote specifically at the end there, that it's an argument that we've lost already. That to me is just is shattering and is kind of like, if you want to know what's wrong with cinema, it's that the people who are most involved in the system ultimately believe that it's futile to try to reject it. And even in spite of what I would argue is, you know, evidence to the contrary, which is, I feel like if you talk to people and ask them like, what were the best, you know, what were some of the best movies that you saw this year that were successful, like a Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse would be one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And even though that is this IP driven thing, I would argue it's unlike any superhero movie I've ever seen, in that it is truly emotional and deep and heartfelt and has layers and is artistic and is trying to do, and not just trying, it does something momentous that I thought I would never see in a superhero movie. And just to me, it's, you know, like The Dark Knight, it gets to move beyond that moniker of being a superhero movie. Like this is something that is elevated higher.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great conversation, and I have one more topic I kind of want to talk about before we close, because I want to get your opinion on it.
Mm-hmm.
Currently we have a writer strike going on in solidarity, an actor strike, and it's not just in solidarity, because there are similar things that are they're both dealing with the idea of digital and how streaming has been raking in money on this model that is not really paying the people who make this stuff in front of and behind the camera the money that they deserve. I think that when this all does shake out, it's going to make a better media landscape, because there's going to be less money to waste at the top, just a giant swings, and there'll be more stability, I think, in things. You know, it won't be like, okay, every month there's five new Netflix shows, only one you've heard of and the others you haven't. Like, I think it might actually create a more, maybe less stuff, but a more fruitful media culture. What do you think? How do you think that the writer strike and the actor strike is going to affect the industry?
It's so, I mean, I just feel like it's so hard to say at this point. Just, I want to believe that, yeah, I agree. Like, I want to believe that it's going to make things better and more equitable. Like, that is the point of the strike. If you think about it, I put this, I think it has the potential, yes, to hopefully help the middle class, or the, you know, the people who are struggling to even be middle class and work in this business.
Mm-hmm.
I think like that's who has the real potential to help. I still have concerns about the fact that you're going to have executives that are still getting paid outrageous amounts, and that you have, you know, frankly, like some actors, more so, like, usually don't see this with the writers, but like, you know, like a Tom Cruise making $20 million a picture or whatever. I really do wish that the actors on that side of the, you know, of that extreme side also, like, maybe, you know, hey, I hate to say it, but, like, maybe there should be a cap on how much you can make, just like there should be a cap on how much you get paid as a, as an executive. There should be a cap even as an actor. Like, do you really, like, do you really need $20 million a picture?
Yeah.
What kind of life do, like, it's the Chinatown argument. For those of you who've ever seen the movie Chinatown, this is in the movie, Jack Nicholson asks John Huston at one point, he's just like, how much better can your food taste? How much do you need? And the sad thing is like, I know a lot of people also charge that kind of money because it's ego. It's like, I have to be the best. And it's like, to me, you know, hey, if you're the best, it's up there on the screen.
Yeah.
And you know it because the work you put in. So that is sort of my concern, that I also worry that some of the people on the lower end are not going to get their deals because some of these people on the higher end are still going to want to make that kind of money. And it's always going to end up hurting the little guy or like the person who's just trying to, you know, make a day's pay. Right.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Although I don't know if it was the article that we were just talking about or a different article, but I was just reading something that was saying, like, where are the new movie stars? Look at our bankable stars. They're all ancient. Look at Harrison Ford's age. Look at
Tom. Yeah.
Like, can you imagine, like, look at the new Indiana Jones movie. Can you, industry that's supposedly obsessed with youth, their major bankable star is a octogenarian? It's kind of wild.
Well, it is this weird thing of, like, the studio system was known for making stars, and then they haven't made any in 25 years.
Yeah.
And what is the fault? What, like, who's at fault for that? Like, I can't, like, I don't know. I don't know if that's the internet or this or that, but, like, it is weird that you have that issue. It's also weird that, like, a lot of the stars who, like, seem to be up and coming also, like, they're not American. Like, it's usually British actors who are wonderful. But it is also the weird, like, why is it that, like, American actors can't seem to find footholds in these big franchises or, you know.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, or, like, maybe American actors are, like, really well, like, they do well on television, but they don't do well at the movies. Why, I can't understand. I don't know.
It's interesting. Well, Mike, thank you so much for being here. This is...
And just nothing but hot takes. Just scorching hot takes.
the hottest of takes. thank you so much for being here.
No problem. Love it.
Yeah, we love having you here. I'm sure you'll be here again soon. We end every episode by saying...
Bye-bye!